really try to get us into a place where we can talk more directly about Gittin. And as we'll see, one of the questions to keep in mind, which will certainly be in the background today, is to what extent Gittin is based on the same principles as other mitzvos. And the assumption that Kriya exists by Gittin, to whatever extent it does, is that because of mitzvos and Kriya existing there, or is it because of something else? So let's try to explore a little bit some of the questions that we asked yesterday. First of all, so what exactly is the mechanics, or really what is the basis for any kfiya at all? So we came up with a few possibilities yesterday, and that maybe it's based on arvus. Maybe it has to do with the fact that we took on a commitment to each other as we entered into Eretz Yisrael, that we are all interdependent. Or maybe it's a function of mitzvah tovacha, which, as we noted, are not thematically so radically different, but they each have their own sources, and that could be relevant as well. So the Tshuva's Chikrei Lev, he assumes that there's a distinction between the two. Rav Asher Weiss quotes this. Rav Asher Weiss has a piece which we'll refer to a few times in his Sefer on Chumash in this week's Parsha. So he notes that Chikrei Lev assumes that there's a distinction between the two, that tochacha is purely verbal. Tochacha is only about saying things. While arvus means that you're really interconnected to everyone else, and therefore, practically, you're going to do whatever you can to make sure that their religious fulfillment is going to be what it has to be, and therefore, to whatever extent there is kfiya, it has to do with this interconnectedness that's known as arvus. Whether or not it's correct in terms of what tochacha entails, so that is a little bit of discussion, but it's an interesting way of framing things and just kind of highlighting the fact that even though thematically these two concepts probably are very connected to each other, so maybe there could be a distinction along those lines, and that that's probably the case, that this is not so much about tochacha, but is about arvus, is about our sense of interconnected responsibility to each other. So that really ties into the question, which we also asked yesterday, of what is it that we're trying to accomplish? Are we trying to change behavior? Is this some kind of an onesh? That's important to know in order if we want to know if it's effective or not. So we have to understand what are we trying to effect. So here, actually, I don't think I put the Shari Tshuva on the Marmar Komos. Did I put that on the list? Okay, I should have put that on the list, so retroactively go look that up. That Shari Tshuva in Shari Gimel, in Os Yudalit, so he seems to phrase this as an onesh. He says, we do see that there is an onesh inflicted even for not doing a mitzvah saseh, and he makes reference to this concept, and he connects it with statements in the Gemara, where it sounds like to fail to do a mitzvah saseh is viewed as a prohibition, or is viewed with some type of guilt that's more than just omission. So, for example, it makes reference to the fact that the Gemara says in Rosh Hashanah that someone who doesn't wear tefillin is considered to be a poshe Yisrael begufa, and somebody who physically is sinning against God, and even though he's not actually doing anything wrong, his failure to do the mitzvah saseh and tefillin gives him this kind of status which sounds punishment worthy. More technically, a question about that?
Does that apply also to this, or just specifically?
So that's a fascinating discussion itself. There is another Gemara that talks about Gemara Masechet Menachos, and there's a whole set of Rishonim over there. Tzitzis is complicated for a couple of reasons. First of all, nowadays, when we wear tzitzis, so we do so really voluntarily as a minute, because the whole garment that we're putting on is itself extra, because we assume the normal garments that we wear today don't have an obligation of tzitzis. So, stam, that's already a level to consider. But let's say you were wearing a four-cornered garment, so then failure to wear tzitzis seems to be a straight-out bittul aseh. There is a discussion, the Rishonim has a lot of relevance also to the Shemitah year, because the Rishonim discussed, the Tosfos over there in Menachos, that discusses what the Gemara says, that the HaKadosh Baruch Hu punishes on a bittul aseh, whatever that means, punishes on an aseh, idon rischa, when things are really bad, when he's angry at us, so then we're eligible to be punished even for a mitzvah saseh. So it's not 100% clear what the scope of that is. Does that mean to say that an aseh that we're chayiv in and we don't do, or that we're not looking to fulfill mitzvot aseh, even if we're not technically chayiv. I mentioned the Shemitah year because there's been a movement in the past to say that maybe we should encourage everyone to purchase some land in Eretz Yisrael during the Shemitah year, because then they'll be able to fulfill the mitzvot aseh of abandoning their crops during the Shemitah year, which they otherwise wouldn't have a chance to do. So it's the whole discussion. I believe our friend Rabbi Rapp wrote an article many years ago about this, the topic of redifa achar hamitzvos. To what extent are you obligated to seek out mitzvah opportunities that you don't necessarily have a existing chiyuv in? And tzitzis may be in this category. So for that reason, tzitzis is different. But even let's say you have a straight out chiyuv tzitzis, so on the one hand, tzitzis could be considered worse, because if you're wearing a four-cornered garment without tzitzis, then that seems to be more in the category of what you might call an active bittul aseh. It may address our question yesterday about, you know, how can you identify when somebody is negating a mitzvah aseh? Maybe they just haven't gotten around to it. So there are some circumstances where there's kind of an active bittul aseh mode, and maybe this would qualify. It's an interesting thing to consider. But the impact of that Gemara in Rosh Hashanah about tefillin is to say that tefillin is a more chomer mitzvah than other mitzvahs, and that the failure to do so gets this special label. In fact, I think Rosh Hashanah Eretz Tzvi distinguishes even between tefillin shel yad and tefillin shel rosh, and that the Gemara specifically talks about a head that has not put on tefillin in distinction to an arm that has not put on tefillin, in order to highlight special significance to tefillin shel rosh. So it doesn't sound like it's really applicable to all mitzvahs aseh, but it's a way of highlighting that there's at least one mitzvah aseh which could be identified with a criticism that sounds like you're actively doing something wrong.
So can we apply these principles to like a mitzvah of Yiras Hashem or Ahavas Hashem?
Yeah, so Rabbi Yonah comments about that elsewhere, that Yiras Hashem is the mitzvah you fulfill when you don't do Averis, the other way. Right, so when you, so the Gemara says it's the opposite. But here we're talking about what are you doing wrong when you don't do a mitzvah. So that's relevant to what are you doing right when you don't do an aver.
So that's a los hasei.
Well, in general, if you commit an aver, you're violating a los hasei. Right. The question is, what do you accomplish by not doing a los hasei? So the Gemara has an expression that somebody who sits and doesn't do any averus is in the fulfillment of the mitzvah. So on that, Rabbi Yonah comments that that's the mitzvah of Yiras Shamayim, which is consistent with Ramban, which we'll talk about also, where he says, well, those aseis are a function of Yiras Shamayim, and all aseis are a function of Avos Hashem. But that would address the other half of the equation. But as far as identifying the passive mitzvah not doer as a sinner, it doesn't necessarily help us so much for that. However, Rabbi Yonah does point out, and this is perhaps even more direct than the reference to the Gemara about Poshe Yisrael Begufan, is that there's a possible violation of Bal Tigra. We have to figure out what exactly the parameters of Bal Tigra are, but it could be that if one fails to do a mitzvah, that one is in violation of Bal Tigra, which also could come up in the Tzitzis discussion and other discussions, that we have to figure out what is exactly the scope of the prohibition in the Torah not to do, not to subtract from the Torah. So it's possible that there's an actual law associated with that. But of course, we also have to figure out how far you want to go with that, because if we are going to assume to some extent that there is a distinction halakhically between aseis and los aseis, so at one point we're going to have to draw the line and say some are in one group and some are in the other group, and it's not going to be so feasible to say, well, all aseis are also a violation of Bal Tigra, so therefore you're chayiv malchus. So you have to figure out exactly how far you want to go with that. But what Rabbeinu Yonah seems to be saying is that we have support to view the sin of omission with a level of stigma that's comparable to a sin of commission. So it's not so surprising that we find an onish that is applied even for a bittul aseh.
We find that the rabbis are willing to do sheva al tasa, so it seems that...
Willing to allow us to go around Torah law for sheva al tasa.
Sheva al tasa, so omission doesn't seem to equate commission.
Right, which was saying a minute ago, that at some point we have to recognize that we are making distinctions for halakhic purposes, so we can't simply say all the aseis or the los aseis to the Bal Tigra. I think we discussed a week or two ago also that to whatever extent you could say that rabbinic law is backed up by a los aseh of los aseh, we can't practically consider all drabbanans to be surim deraisa. That's not going to work either. So we have to figure out exactly how far you want to go with this kind of a comparison. Rav Asher Weiss also comments that he doesn't think Rabbeinu Yonah could really mean it literally, because to say it's an onesh is problematic for other reasons. Right? Why else is it problematic in our circumstance to call it an onesh?
The criteria of Acha, how does that relate to onesh?
Okay, that's a fair question, although we have to consider whether our Gemara actually says that. Right? That phrase appears in a few other places, which we'll have to consider the implication. But even just looking at our Gemara doesn't actually have that phrase, but what's maybe on the track or something. Nachum, you want to comment on that?
Is there necessarily an onesh for not doing an aseid?
Well, the most part we assume not, and the Torah generally isn't, with the notable exception of Bris Milah and Korban Pesach.
So then, by calling this an onesh, then...
But that's a little bit of Rabbeinu Yonah's point, that even though in the Torah we don't really have it, but okay, so we see that in practice in Halacha there is such a concept. So that's already his chiddush, so we can't necessarily identify that as the problem, but there is something more fundamental to the whole mechanics search in terms of what's the punishments you want to continue.
And is this also, so, right, we passed him mitzvah saying on the Srichos Kavanah.
Oh, so that's
right?
The important.
So
you want to know what you accomplished.
In terms of Rotsani, so that's why Rotsani, even though he says, because he says he wants to do it, but that's not really true, he just doesn't want to get beaten.
Okay, so hold on to that point. So we'll come back to that point. That's a very important point on a couple levels. So hold on to that point. But there's maybe a more fundamental problem with calling this an onesh. All right?
Perhaps because the Gemara says, Bamed Varma Murim, that someone gets Malkus, is for Losa Asay. And so that's putting in distinction from violating an Asay, which gets Machno. So
that's an important point also. I have to come back to that too. What distinction is the Gemara trying to say? It's not 100% clear. You're raising an important point. Is that the distinction the Gemara is trying to draw? Maybe. We'll have to come back to that also. But I'm thinking of something which you don't really need a source for, something a little bit more fundamental. Just
like, do you need like Kasra and Edom based in?
Okay, it's closer. But something even more fundamental than that. Ready? Now it's all anyway.
You could theoretically always fulfill an
asay. Oh, okay. So that's possible. That's closer on the right. It's further on the right track. Since you could always fulfill it, so then what is the problem here with calling this a punishment? That essentially, well, maybe I'll take the next step, that you haven't done anything yet. Even if you consider omission commission, but you haven't committed the omission yet. You haven't failed to do the mitzvah yet. No.
But that's like what we said yesterday. Like we were talking about. So when are you actually not committing? Because if the
right, and that question
the zman was over, then we can't force you to do it because the mitzvah is over already.
Right.
So it's like a catch 22.
Exactly.
But
so
when would that be like the Gemara brings up Sukkah and Lulav.
Mm-hmm.
So based on the previous day, let's say the first day of Sukkah, we saw that you didn't shake Lulav.
Uh-huh.
So can't we say the second day we see you're not shaking it, so we're saying, oh, he's just doing what he did yesterday.
So you say, come off of Chazakah.
Yeah, or something like that.
There's possibly some precedent to work off that, but that's itself interesting. So let's see if that actually fits. Because on the surface, what it sounds like is happening here is that, and this is a problem again, and Rush Weiss points this out also, that you have to wonder where the punishment is here, because he has not yet negated the mitzvah saseh. So whatever is, that's the catch 22 was identified yesterday, we won't actually be able to say that he's done anything wrong yet. So what this amounts to is, even if we're afraid that he will, so it seems like we are punishing then for intent, which is not something that we find in halacha, right? That we should punish for your desire to do something wrong. Again, even we'll call it doing something wrong, even though it's passive, but even if you want to go that far, there's a technical problem with that. So all of that maybe means that Rabbeinu Yonah's point is not necessarily to call this actual onesh, but to say, to make a point over there, in general, there's been some debate about this. A rabbi once made this point to me. We talked a few weeks ago about Habanus Panei Chaver Baravim, so I meant reference here to the Rabbeinu Yonah that takes the Gemara literally about Yehar Vayavor. I once spoke in the shul about this, and the rabbi said to me afterwards that he didn't think it was really true, l'halacha, because you can't necessarily possibly based on what Rabbeinu Yonah says in the Shai Shuvah. He thinks that Rabbeinu Yonah is writing a Musar Sefer, and it has a different weight to it, the way he makes the statements. Yeah. So how far you want to go with that is a question, but here it might be a relevant point to argue also. So is he literally saying it's an Onesh? Or is he making the Musar point here that fail to do a assay, don't take it lightly, don't think that this is something that, well, it's just passive, it's just a sin of omission, it's not something that we have to worry about so much, and here's therefore bringing all these points that show us that it could be very serious, Koshi Yisrael B'Gufan, Baltigra, Malchus, which seems like some kind of an onish, without maybe necessarily qualifying it exactly as a onish. Amir?
Could there be a specific scenario which is clearly not intended? He hasn't yet done mitzvah, but he clearly indicates that he's not going to do the mitzvah, so wouldn't necessarily, I mean, we could punish him not based entirely on intent, but on the fact that we just know based on all his actions up to this point, he's not going to do the mitzvah.
So then you're basically punishing him for the past.
You're punishing him for what he's doing now because he's clearly not planning on being kind of
smitzvah up to whatever. So what you're suggesting, and you're getting into a very radical punitive theory here, and this could affect how the United States operates also, is that maybe we'll have to come on to that as we increasingly have to fight the terrorism and a technological era, and who knows, we may have to have approaches like this. What you're basically saying is that why don't we, this is really entering the realm of science fiction a little bit, right? You're saying, but why don't we punish you for things you have not yet done, it's only because you always may have the excuse you weren't going to do it. But if, for legal purposes or halachic purposes, we could establish that we're sure you're going to do it, that let's say we could see that was the case, then we would even punish you proactively. We'd even punish you beforehand. And the only reason we don't is because there will always be some kind of a possibility that you'll get out of it. So when there's enough of a chazaka, then maybe so.
Could be. Your free will.
Sorry?
That takes away your free will.
Well, maybe yes, maybe not, because maybe, and that opens up other philosophical questions, right? Because we do find that there are theoretically limitations on free will within such a context as far as punishment is concerned for past behaviors. What I mean, that's a long sentence. But the Rishonim who talk about, we may have talked about this a little bit this year in Chumash, I don't remember, but the beginning of Parshas Bo and Parshas B'Shalach, where there's all these references to Paro having his heart hardened. So the Rishonim, the Rambam, the Sefer Karim, and others try to figure out what happened to free will over there. So there is a discussion, which is very relevant, you know, to some of the topics we'll see today, that do we assume that free will is always there, or free will is there initially when you establish your path in life, but it theoretically is possible for a person to travel so far down a certain path that he loses his free will. So to a certain extent, in practice, we clearly do believe that, right? We clearly do believe that somebody with a pattern of bad behavior becomes progressively less and less trusted and less in a position to say, well, I'll change everything tomorrow. So speaking even just from plain legal philosophy. So there are increasing limitations on how much we credit your free will, how much we say, well, you have the ability to change tomorrow, therefore we're not going to hold your past against you. That clearly narrows based on your past decisions. So that might be true just practically as far as human beings. It may even be true as far as how God treats you, which is some of the positions you find among the Rishonim regarding Paro. So here we could say again that we're not interested in a society necessarily in honoring your free will. If your behavior has earned you a lack of credit, so that we're, I'm not even saying any of this is true, but I'm saying that theoretically we could make such a position and say that maybe you could justify proactively punishing someone if we establish some kind of a legal standard that said we're sure enough that this is going to happen. It may not be true at all, but say, theoretically, if you wanted to see this as an onesh, proactively, maybe there is room to formulate a position like that. Want to comment on that?
I just want to ask, we said that perhaps Rabbeinu Yonah and Shari Shuva shouldn't be used as a halachic source.
Maybe. Also, not necessarily advocating that position, just saying that it has been commented to me by others.
The Hobbes Chaim uses.
Oh yeah, for
very
sure.
Very much.
Right, yeah.
So
I certainly
it'd be very difficult
to. No question. And that's also an interesting topic to delve into. But again, I'm not endorsing that comment necessarily, but I'm saying that if one were to take that position, that the statements in Shaar Tshuva are more homiletic than halachic, then maybe that could also explain his usage of Elnish in this context. Maybe not, but I certainly agree with you. There's a lot to question about that, and we did talk about it in the context of Elnish Mecha of Rabin, even though this comment was from many years ago. So, in any event, so one could also note that Rashi and our daf, at least when I say our, at least it's in Ksubas, it's our daf. So the top Rashi and Pevav and Beis, the top, right, what does Rashi say? Makino so, how does Rashi understand that? Kodam sha'avar al ha'esei, v'yesh v'yado l'kayim. Right there, Rashi emphasizes that he has not yet violated the essay. So the concern here, he's not dealing with a question of how do we define that moment when the essay is negated. That's not even necessarily his interest. He's saying whatever it is, it has not yet happened. There's still time to save him. So he has not yet negated the essay, whatever that would mean. It's still possible to do it. So it sounds like we're really talking about a non-onesh in this context, that it's not about punishing him for what has happened. Even if we found a way to define a bittul essay as an action, we still are not addressing that. This is dafka the opposite, that, well, not the opposite, but a different goal of there's still time to do something. All right?
Wouldn't the scenario be that you would basically go up to a person and say, you know, today's Sukkot or whatever, you need to shake lulav today. So why don't you shake lulav? And if the person says, no, I'm not going to do that, then you can say basically, well, we're going to beat you until you do it. And then if the person still doesn't do it, you beat him. Like,
so, but again, that scenario still, we were saying the scenario still is not necessarily a punishment, because at no point did he ever actually
He made it clear that he's not going to do it, and that even once you threaten him with physical pain, doesn't want to do it.
So you're taking Tamir's point one step further, and saying that maybe, again, it's kind of proactive punishment, but not based on chazaka, or it's maybe could also address Yosef's point about free will. So we'll say that here we should be even less likely to credit your free will, because you've stated that your free will is to not do this. So therefore,
where there's clear intent, basically.
Right, so basically, you could theoretically formulate such a model. It would be a chiddush, both in terms of legal philosophy and punitive theory and halacha, but maybe there's room to say that, and maybe there's room to say that if we could establish that this person plans on doing something wrong, either because of his past behavior has made such a policy, or because he has said so, right? Which, you know, is, you find this coming up also in American laws, comes up all the time, right? People, let's say in terms of hurting other people, people make threats, right? And unless a threat sometimes has its own legal standing, but it's not going to get you punished the same way as if you actually commit the crime, right? So even when you could establish that somebody's intent is there to commit a crime, we don't treat it in any system that we're a part of so far as having actually committed the crime. So it's interesting. The guy that is handing one.
Could it be different by get? Because if by not giving a get, you're like hurting the wife. You're hurting your wife.
So it could be. We'll see. There might be a lot of reasons to distinguish between get and other things. So we have to see. But first, we have to figure out what's the general principle, and then we have to figure out what we see about get. Is that a part of this, or is this something else? But you definitely correct in that there might be major grounds to distinguish between getting other things. So we're not at the continuation.
Doesn't Rashi sound like even less than that?
I do think Rashi.
Before he's over on the essay, and he's yesh b'yado, like he could do it.
Yeah,
so
I think it is less than that.
Okay, like you don't even have clear intent. You just see that he hasn't done it yet.
Right.
You know,
so the
he
point
has the ability to do it. So what, you're just going to walk over them and hit him? Like,
yeah, so the point being that it's not an onesh. I think that's what Rashi does seem to be indicating. That we have to assume it's not about onesh, but it's about trying to save the day. And since he still can do something, then, and seems to be highlighting that specifically. So you're saying even less than that, but it's more than that in a sense, because he's saying not just you hit him even before, and all the more so after, he's emphasizing only before. Right? Okay. Let's pretend for a second, because Rashi's not addressing this, let's pretend for a second that we could pinpoint the moment at which you are mevatel the essay. You are over on the essay. So whatever that moment is, Rashi says, we're only talking about before that moment. In other words, we're kind of excluding punishment from this story. We're saying, kodem sh'avar al ha'essay. V'yesh b'yad al-makayim. Because there's still room to reverse things, that's why we're doing this. It sounds like it's not about punishment at all. And in fact, your Sameach and Hilchos Mamrim also adds, which clearly puts it in a different category from what you're suggesting, that, at least the way he understands it, that if it's clear that you're hitting him is not going to make a difference, and he's not going to do it no matter what, so then you don't do that. So that's a little bit the opposite of what you just said. Right? You said that if we got a clear statement from him that no matter what, he's not going to do it, and we threatened him, we're going to hit him, he still says he's not going to do it, therefore he deserves the punishment. The Or Samech is clearly understanding it the opposite way, and saying that if that's the case, then we don't even do it in the first place, because the only point is to get him to do it, not to inflict punishment. And if we know this is not going to be productive, then we're not going to do it that way. Tamir, you have a...
Yeah, so according to Rashi, then, at what point would we then be able to start hitting him? Because you don't know if they intend to.
Right, that's a fair question.
That
right, that's a big open detail that has to be clarified. Where exactly do you start to hit him? Right, so then you could say that he says, you have to just go somewhere in the middle, where he says, I'm not going to do it, I think, unless you really start hitting me. And then you kind of get the sense that it's going to, there's some room to weaken. Then it's probably that middle ground, but it's like definitely kind of an ambiguous context. Not really
finishing. Wouldn't this seem to be like the last step?
Not
until he dies, I guess.
But also wherever the stages where, because we clarified yesterday again, do not try this at home, that we're not going to have people dying in any context, hopefully. But Rashi here is not just saying about that. It sounds like Rashi is saying specifically that while there's still time to do it, and that if that time passes, however we define that, so then there's no point. And your Sameach is adding that even if you can anticipate that you're not going to have any impact with this, so then don't do it. But it's interesting, also just to illustrate your question about what exactly the scenario is, and to illustrate how you find some differences here. So if you're familiar with the Sefer Shara Mitzion and B'Halacha, the Shara Mitzion and B'Halacha is a commentary on Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. It's most well known for that. It's written by Shlomo Zalman Braun. But he also wrote a lot of other things, so you can also get, it was published more recently, I think, his Chidushim on the Daf. So throughout Shas, he has his comments, his halachically oriented comments. So he has a Sefer and Ksubis also. So he has a hard time with this scenario. It's a little bit similar to what Menachem is asking. He says, how exactly do you talk, what is this case here? Sukkah Shani Ose. So what's the scenario? What's going on? Right? So first of all, there's a technical problem whenever you start talking about Sukkah and these phrases just parenthetically. So, but it's also very relevant here, that presumably there is no mitzvah to make a Sukkah. Without getting into all the details of that question, we could, you know, if we were synergistically at the other half of the year, then we could take the opportunity to talk about the mitzvah of Sukkah. But a few weeks before Pesach, with all due respect to Gzeir Shavu Tesvav, we can't really appropriate time to talk about the mitzvah of Sukkah. But just parenthetically, it's relevant to understanding this Gemara that building a Sukkah is presumably not a mitzvah. That if your neighbor has a Sukkah, which he lets you use, so then you don't have any obligation at all, really, to build a sukkah. Is it maybe some kind of a heksha mitzvah? There's an etziv about that. That's a whole discussion. But you just have to understand what this line even means. Make a sukkah. So some of the mafarshim say it doesn't really mean make a sukkah, that you find this in other contexts also. The Gemara Nedarim uses the same phrase, that it really means do the mitzvah of sukkah, which then would mean sit in the sukkah. So asks the Shar Mitzionim B'Halacha, so when is this coming up? So there's only one time, now to go back to that, Gzeir Shavu Tesvav, right, there's only one time when somebody has a chiyuv to sit in the sukkah. When is that? right, but the mechiyev is the first night. It's the seir shavat hatzvav tesvav, just like we have a mitzvah to eat matzah the first night of Pesach and a mitzvah to sit in the sukkah first night of Sukkot. So it can't be this conversation is happening before Sukkot, because then why should we assume he's not going to do it? He hasn't built a sukkah yet, so what? He doesn't have to build a sukkah. So this conversation must only be relevant Yontif night. So how could you do this? He asks Yontif night. We have a klal that Beis Din does not impose an onesh on Shabbos or Yontif. So how could we allow this? So he has a whole back and forth. But presumably, one could say the question doesn't really have to really start, because the assumption is that this is a onesh of Beis Din. That's the premise of his question. But we could say, and he has a whole back and forth how exactly to make it work, but he could say that it's not an onesh. An onesh, yes, indeed, is imposed after the fact, and that does not take place on Shabbos. But this is not about onesh. This is about Kol Yisrael Arevim, about making sure that mitzvos get fulfilled. And therefore, it's not limited to the rules of Beis Din, which also doesn't function at night either, so that would also be an issue. But it's not necessarily limited to Beis Din, and that's something that is in a different category. Now, you could say that the whole question, like you said, is not really relevant, but you still have to figure out, and we'll get to this hopefully, that whether or not you need a Beis Din in order to do whatever this is, whether it's an onesh or something else. So there is room to say that you need a Beis Din, but it's not a onesh of Beis Din, which requires not happening on Shabbos. So there's room to distinguish between the two. But the easiest way to address his question about the technicalities here is to say that whether or not this needs a Beis Din, it's not an onesh, and therefore it doesn't have this limitation that it can't happen on Yantin. Okay, so it's also significant to this whole question is if you saw the Ramban, his commentary to Parshas Yisro, that was on the Maran Komos yesterday, so he adds in one word here, which is very significant. What's the word that he adds in? He adds in the word Merudin, sounds like. You're dealing with people who are rebellious, which is an important distinction in general, because it could be that we're not necessarily, that one word really, the Ramban is always worth paying careful attention to, but that one word possibly may recast everything that we're talking about. That maybe this is not about the fulfillment of mitzvot in general, maybe it's not about arvus even, maybe it's about the public impact of someone rebelling against the halachic system by very publicly disdaining a mitzvah. And therefore, that one word can have implications for every part of this. What are we trying to accomplish? Who's trying to accomplish it? Under what circumstances are we trying to accomplish it? To what extent do we have to worry about how sincere his compliance is going to be? All of that perhaps could be addressed by that language. And he also has, the way he phrases it, that the person is saying sukkah in the answer. So perhaps that's what's going on, as they point out, that it's not simply that he is not in fulfillment of the mitzvah of sukkah. Maybe that's not our problem so much, that he's not going to score points for the mitzvah of sukkah. What is our problem is that he's publicly rebelling against the mitzvah of sukkah, and that has an impact on everyone else. And that's something as a society that we can't allow. And maybe it's only within a context in which that's what's clearly happening that we have to take such coercive action. So that one word, again, very significant, could have all kinds of implications for what's going on, for how it should happen, for when it should be applied, what's the context. It could really redefine pretty much almost all the issues that we've seen so far. Sammy?
Does Merudin mean that he's rebellious in this specific scenario, or he has like a history in the past of being someone who is a Merudin?
Yeah, you certainly could open up that question, but that's a fair question to ask him himself. One would probably, the truth is probably both, because the point is that right now he's acting in a rebellious manner, probably that's what it sounds like he's saying. And therefore the question is, how do you define that? So you might define that based on how he's going about it. You might define it based on his past history. You might ascertain it in a number of ways. So probably that's part of the whole picture, that if he has a history of being rebellious, so then that might allow us to see this as more rebellious. Daniel?
Does that mean you're only referring to mitzvot asei, which are not necessarily shasman gavi, you could say, but mitzvot that apply at the time? Because, like, what is
mitzvot
asei?
Is the phrase, yeah.
Yeah, because let's say it's the middle of Adar now.
Correct.
Somebody's not learning Torah, right?
Right, so we'd have to have a demonstrable moment. Although others pick time for learning Torah, tell them to put that sign up during midterms and midterms for other. But Marvin Simcha, you know, in Simcha Torah, Marvin Simcha might be reason not to have midterms and other at all, which is up for Torah's point.
Tell them that.
Right, which is a midterm like a din, you know, that you should push it off till you should dafka have it in other, not have them in other. That's our policy, we don't have midterms and other. All right, so in any event, but so your point is well taken. We should get to the point or another, I guess, to hear the statement that you're making. But, you know, you are right that we probably have to have a mitzvah that's very clearly identifiable within a certain time, and that if it's not, although, you know, we find it, as we were discussing the past few weeks, in the context of stuck also, which is less definable as far as a moment, but more overall impact understood. So you probably have a few standards, but you're right, there needs to be something where we can really point to this and say, or maybe that we're forced to point to it because it's so in our face, and say, okay, this person is purposely negating that. So what could even, if one wants to take that stance, so, you know, the sukkah any osa, even though the asiyas sukkah is not a mitzvah, but you can imagine, let's say, for example, let's say you have a Jewish settlement where everyone lives in the same kind of houses, everyone has the same kind of materials, and everyone could equally make a sukkah on their roof, or balcony, whatever it is they have there, and one house that is blatantly refusing to. So the effect that has on the whole communal cohesiveness, you know, one could see how there's a difference between that and simply not accruing the spiritual credit of the mitzvah, and maybe that's what we're talking about here. Okay, so this has a couple of other implications also. So Aryeh raised the question before that our Gemara was drawing some kind of a distinction. Right? That the Gemara said, Bamed, Devarim, Mamurim, something is different than this. And then somehow the difference is, Mitzvah is lo saseh, or Mitzvah saseh. So we then give him these malchus. So what exactly is the chiluk? Some things we do for a mitzvah saseh, some things we do only for a lo saseh. So is it the difference between how many malchus you give? This whole idea that we're going to give malchus kind of proactively, so does that only apply to asays? Is that what our Gemara is saying? So that appears to be a machlokas rishon. So on the one hand, the Rambam in the Sefer HaMitzvos, in which I think may qualify for yesterday's TOD, because some of you looked very hard for Nishorosh Yudalit and refused to break out of the constraints of assuming that just because there's a Yud there that should be, you know, something you should take seriously. That and you simply refuse to look in Nishorosh Dalit, realizing that, you know, it's got to be a typo of the day. So the Rambam in Nishorosh Dalit in the Sefer HaMitzvos, the Rambam seems to imply this is only by mitzvah saseh that we have this idea. But there's a Tosus that we've seen in the past that clearly applies kfiya to lo saseis. I didn't put it on the list because we've seen it already a few times. Which Tosus am I talking about? I want to refresh our memory. We saw it not so long ago. But the Tosus about stalker. Right? The Tosus and the intestine debates in our Masechta. About tzedaka, Tosfos asked the question, well, how could you have kfiya by tzedaka? Aye, it's a mitzvah saseh, but it has an exception because matan tzchara b'tzida, which itself is interesting, right? The whole idea that only certain assays yes and certain assays no is itself an interesting point. But what is Tosfos' answer? Right, Tosus' more well-known answer is that, oh, but here the kfiya is because of the lo saseis. So apparently it's not a concept that's limited to asays, but lo saseis seem to certainly also get kfiyah happening because of them. So this is also a machlokus on the level of the achronim. And if you look here, the Maran shift in the back of the Gemara and Radaf and the Hafla, so they assume that there isn't really a distinction in our Gemara between Aseis and Los Aseis. What the Gemara was really distinguishing is between things that happened and things that have yet to happen. That things that have happened, somebody violated the law, so then, okay, there's a set number of malchus. But when something is going to happen, so then there's the concept of, say, Afrusha Meisura, that you want to stop the Yisr from happening, and that's where you get this Hachitei Tzei Nafsho concept. And there isn't any distinction at that level between whether it's a ase or a los ase.
Maybe someone says, I intend to do with exavera.
So that's apparently how you would understand it. Chavis Yor has a tshuva, which is a little difficult to understand. Rosh Weiss talks about it also, that he says he thinks there is a distinction between a los ase and ase. And you have to figure out exactly what he means by this. He seems to say that when it comes to the los ase, so all right, then it's basically done already. But when it comes to the ase, so then you know that's still something which you can try to address. But you have to figure out exactly if that distinction holds up. But that's a part of this whole question. Are we talking about limiting this concept specifically to ases? Or is it a concept that applies to los aseis also? Danny?
Can we split up when we're talking about onish? Can we split the aseis and los aseis and say that we're only applying onish to
los aseis?
Yeah,
presumably. Right. It's a different category. So what our Gemara is really talking about, the distinction, is talking about two different types of malchus. That the malchus that are for an onish, that's for the los aseis. And here we're introducing a concept of afrasha meisura, which really applies regardless of what kind of aver it is that you do.
With the los aseis, it seems to be malchus.
Martus, right, which that word is also significant because we can say that's true here also according to the Ramban, right? The phrase malchus martus, which means the malchus to prevent you from rebelling. Right. So, the question has also been raised so far by us is, you know, so what exactly are you accomplishing with this type of fear, that presumably mitzvos need to be done willingly to some extent, and we have a concept, this machlokas, it's fascinating because it's such an important machlokas, and it's actually not really resolved, but we have a machlokas in general, we say mitzvos trichos kavana or not. So we assume that mitzvos have to have intent. So it's a whole question. The Gemara says, if you want to make a Yom Yoma, the Gemara says if somebody was tied up as a hostage by some invaders and forced to eat matzah, so then the question is asked, does he fulfill matzah in that context? And there are many other Gemaras which touch upon this, and how exactly the Paskin is a subject of a lot of debate, just parenthetically. Shulchan Aruch writes that you need to have kavana for Kriya Shema. So there's a whole range of interpretations. What does that mean? Does that mean he's saying mitzvahs dunya kavana? Does that mean that he thinks that it's a suffix, so a mitzvah daraisa like Kriya Shema needs kavana, and others don't? Is he saying that Kriya Shema is only words, so that needs kavana, but a mitzvah like matzah, which is more physical and objective, so then it doesn't need kavana? It's a big question how exactly we paskin on this, even after looking at what the Shulchan Aruch says. So, how does this idea work with kavana? And so, do we say that it's possible for a person to have kavana under such circumstances? And if somebody fulfills a mitzvah with a gun to his head, so to speak, so is that kiyum mitzvah? Especially if we want to say, we want to be consistent, which we're not always consistent in these ways, but if we want to say that an aveira under those circumstances would not be held against you. So can we say that a mitzvah under those circumstances should be credited to you? So there's a lot
other
to talk
than
about.
The big three, right.
Sorry?
Other than the big three.
Right. So then is there a mitzvah equivalent to that? Is there something we're saying that the mitzvah that's so important that it's, maybe you could make a case, but is that what we're talking about? Maybe in a sense, if we're saying that like the Ramban and Vine, that it's all about rebellion, and that here we're saying all we want is for you not to publicly rebel. We don't really care what it is you're actually doing mitzvah-wise, so then that might be a part of what's going on here. The Turiyevin assumes that you can fulfill a mitzvah, which is interesting because we'll have to expand on this in the subject of Gittin. But the Turiyevin in Rosh Hashanah and Daf Chav Ches, where Akimaya talks about being forced to eat matzah, the Turiyevin has a chiddush, which Rashi Weiss does not like, doesn't think is correct, that the Gemara suggests that you were tied up by invaders who were specifically non-Jewish invaders, as it sounds like from the Gemara, who forced you to eat matzah. Because, he says, if it was, let's say, Jewish invaders, if it was a Beis Din, so then you would fulfill the mitzvah no matter what, because their kavana would count for your kavana, which is a big chiddush. It could be that here, the point is not so much that they're forcing you to do the mitzvah, but they are breaking down the resistance. And then at that point, you then do the mitzvah of your own free will, which is a fascinating idea, which we'll expand on in a second. Right.
Is there such thing as your Yotze B'diavan versus Yotze B'chatela?
Yeah, you know, that's also interesting. You know, that there's a Meiri, the Bachanan, who says that, this is a little scary, who says that if you say mitzvos ein tzrichos kavana, so all that means is that the mitzvah is done, but you don't actually get any credit for that. So it's kind of a very b'di'evit kind of circumstance that you don't actually get tzchar mitzvah without intending to do the mitzvah, but the mitzvah is accomplished. There's a interesting comment on the Chassinuch that the Sefer Achinuch, I did put on the list, right? The Sefer Achinuch, where he talks about being kofel mitzvah. So where does he talk about it? By Korban Pesach, right? So why does it show up there all of a sudden? So first of all, it sounds like he's saying that that's the context where mitzvos could be compelled. And the Menachas Chinuch comments over there says that it's specifically there that he brings it up because the mitzvos before that, so they're more result-oriented mitzvos. Kuravu and Mila, which is interesting, I'll have to come back to that. And therefore, his point basically is that when it's a result-oriented mitzvah, so then we know that kfiyah works, because then we see we're interested in what comes out of it, so we don't really care whether you have intent for the mitzvah or not, or whether you're doing this of free will. We know that the result has happened, so that's enough for us. So there, for sure, kfiyah would work, says Menachas Chinuch. But it's specifically, once you get up to a mitzvah like Korban Pesach, which really is only just about whether you are mekayim a mitzvah or not, so then you might say that kfiyah should not get involved. So, says the Menachas Chinuch, that's why the Sefer Achinuch brings it up specifically there. It's a very interesting comment. Now, here is where one could also wonder, as some of you asked me this morning, and many discuss, so the Rambam's very famous comments, which you got a chance to see inside now, in the end of the second parak of Hilchos Gerushin. What exactly are the significance of these comments? So just in terms of assessing how much time I have left, we'll spend a few minutes talking about these comments now, and we're probably going to run out of time. So we're going to segue from this topic into Gittin, which this is a good point of segue, but we have a little bit more to say. So tomorrow is a Parsha day. Sunday we'll talk about some other issues, Pesach related. So we'll continue on Monday with really taking on Gittin Kfiya more head on. This is one of the points which will kind of segue from one to the other. But the Rambam in Hilchos Gerushin, the Rambam says, why is it that we have such a concept as having Beis Din force it? So how does he explain, right, that the inner ratzon of the Jew is to fulfill mitzvahs. And therefore, when we compel the giving of the get, so that is really just allowing the insight to come out. That is really just allowing his pintle yid, essentially, to express itself. Now, this Rambam is hugely significant on so many different levels. So just to kind of lay out why. So first of all, he is assuming, and we'll have to see whether or not this is true, that the kfiya by a get is the same category as the kfiya that we're reading about here, which is not an obvious point. One could bring up many reasons whether or not to link the two, or maybe you could say that the Rambam isn't even necessarily linking the two, but those of us who quote the Rambam in this context are linking the two, and maybe we shouldn't, which is a fair question to ask. But possibly this is relevant to our sugya, and possibly it's not. Possibly the get issue may have chumras and kulas. The get issue may have reasons why kriya should work more, why kriya should work less. But it's not necessarily the same category. But it's interesting whether or not it's applicable here to consider this idea that you have this inner ratzon to do the mitzvah, to do ratzon Hashem, and all we're doing is taking away the distractions, so to speak. And this plugs in also to a philosophical discussion about Paro that we mentioned a few minutes ago. There are some Rishonim who say that was pshat. Some of the Rishonim say that really Paro is being punished for his genuine ratzon. That his genuine ratzon was not to let the Jews out. And the Makos would have weakened him and made him act against his true ratzon, because he would have let them out simply because of the Makos and not because of what he really wants. So when God hardened his heart, it was a way of getting rid of this external distraction of the Makos so that his real ratzon was reflective and he's judged for that. That's a little bit kind of the inverse here. So here, what the Rambam seems to be saying is that your inner ratzon is to do the right thing, and you have some kind of Yetzirah that's getting in the way, so we're allowing you to forget about the Yetzirah and focus on more important things. Yeah?
Is that only kosher get if based in is when it does that?
On the surface, yeah. But on the surface, but there's a lot of us think that's going to be a topic we'll talk about for a long time. The details of this we have much ahead of us, but they'll have to figure out exactly when yes and when no. Hi.
Yeah, but if you get rid of his Ratzon, isn't that the whole point of why he should be doing mitzvah in the first place? Meaning, it's like he's voluntarily doing the mitzvah, so he feels that, you know, that something that's going to get him closer.
Well, I assume that's what we know, that's what we want. Now, part of it, we have to figure
out. It's not like he's doing it at all.
So that seems to be what the Rambam is addressing. Now, parenthetically, one of the questions why we might want to distinguish, as we'll get into more, there are all kinds of reasons to distinguish between get and other issues, get and mitzvos in general. But one of them, which maybe is in a different direction, is that a get, specifically, we have this halacha of ratzon, which isn't necessarily true by mitzvos. Right, and the phrase, which I was calling attention to before when somebody mentioned this, Ad Shiyoma Rotza Ani, doesn't actually appear in our Gemara. It appears in other contexts, such as Get, and it appears in the Rashi in this week's Parsha. Right, so that's also relevant, that the Rashi about Korban, that Korban, because that's what the Pasuk is. Right, so I got a little synergy here from the Parsha. So the Pasuk that Rashi is commenting on, so there, maybe we have a whole different set of factors. Because the language of the Pasuk is Yakriv L'Ritzono. So if that's the case, so Yakriv tells us that we have to even compel him. But L'Ritzono means that it has to somehow be a Yakriv L'Ritzono, it's Pasuk Gimel. Right, so that's where Rashi comments, Kekotfenoso ad shiyoma rotzon. So when it comes to get and karban, we have this requirement of ratzon. So there, we need the kriya to get to the stage of rotzon. Our Gemara maybe specifically doesn't have that phrase because it's not necessarily relevant to mitzvos in general. Although some might disagree. So it is interesting. How exactly to read this Rambam in a broader context or to see it specifically is addressing the Ratzon issues of a get. There is a Sefer which we'll have an opportunity to refer to many times in the Gittin Sugyas about Kfiya Begetin, called Kfiya Begetin. It's called the Elu Kofen Lahotzi, written by Rav Goldberg. So in the introduction to the Sefer, more Al Pidar Chadrush, so he talks about this Rambam. He talks about what exactly is the Rambam telling us with this idea of the inner ratzon, and he makes reference to an idea that we've been talking about. It's not beyond Yom Pesach, but the Purim and Shavuos, the idea of the Kabbalah Torah. Right? So we know we spoke about it a little bit Purim time, that the Gemara says in Shabbos that, here's this word again, Kfiya, right? That the Kodesh Baruch Hu Kofu Aleim, or he turned it around, but it's Kofu with us, it's not exactly the same word, but he forced us to accept the Torah, and that we were not willing to, until God held the mountain overhead and say, accept it, and then Purim time we accepted it more willingly. Kibbul kibbul hayuhu. So the Rishonim discuss what exactly is the issue. Tosfos discusses how this really does seem to be a blatant contradiction to the Pesukim, that the Torah tells us Nasa v'nishma, but we said Nasa v'nishma, so how does that stem with the idea of it being forced on us? I think I mentioned the other day, it's really interesting, because if you look in the Gemara, it's amazing that the Stira isn't addressed even more prominently, because the Gemara really has the two concepts right next to each other. Peches and Shabbos, first you have the story of Kafu, Leim Har Kegigas, and then right after that you have the Gemara saying, oh, the Malachim were so impressed with us that we said, Nasa Mishma, we were so willing. So it does seem like there's a blatant contradiction that has to be addressed there. So Tosfos suggests that it was about later, that really the Jews accepted it willingly at first, but there was a concern that later on they wouldn't stick to it, and therefore there had to be kfiya for that purpose. So the Maral has an approach where he says differently. He says that they were trying to, that they had to understand that the world couldn't exist without the Torah. The world was created for the purposes of the Torah. So they might get the impression, okay, we willingly accepted this, so therefore we could also take it lightly later because it was all based on our decision to accept it. So God had to show them, no, that if you don't accept the Torah, there's no world, and it's not going to be a matter of just your options later on. But the author of the Sefer suggests differently. I think what he's trying to get at is he's saying that, and you see this from the Rambam also, that the Jews had to be made to understand that you don't have a functioning in this world without sometimes a need for external kfiyah, that you can't expect that because you're once upon a time interested that it's always going to continue that way, and that you're never going to have any temptations to stray off the path, that it's a natural part of humanity that you're going to need a enforcement system in order for a commitment to continue. And that's what Akash Baruch Hu was saying, that yes, it's wonderful that you accepted the Torah, but you also have to understand that it's now an absolute commitment that comes with external enforcement, because without that, your commitment's not going to come. Actually, I spoke about this at an offer for Parshas and Mishpatim, that that's essentially the question that you have. Otherwise, a theory here that presumably you have to explain why it is that if you say Kafu and Harki Gigas, besides just figuring out what exactly is the resolution between the two Gemaras, but you have other questions, that why is it fair to force the Torah on the Jews if they don't want to accept it, and why are they crediting it at all if it was totally against their will? So why are they given any credit for this? So you have to assume that Yeshu, that the Etzem HaKabbalah was coming from the Jews, and they deserve tremendous credit for that. The fact that nobody else was willing to accept it, and they were Nasa V'Nishma, means they recognize that this is the gift that it is. But even within that, you also have to understand that it comes then with a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week commitment. It's not going to be something that you can just take or leave at your will, but it has to come with this absolute guarantee, which is really what marriage is about. In a marriage, a person falls in love, and then thinks it's always going to be the most romantic thing. They're always going to feel like they're at such a high of emotions. And the Mitzvah says life is highs and lows, and life has moments of a stronger commitment and lesser commitment. So the chap of marriage, our whole Masech is about, right, the chap of Exubis, is that it's not enough to have that initial infatuation, but that there has to be then a commitment. That means that, okay, it's great that you feel like that now, but then you have to stick to that all the time. So that's essentially what the Kabbalah Sator is conveying also. So that's what the Rabbi is perhaps reflecting, that we know that this person, we know from everything else, this person wants to be a religious Jew. He wants to rest in Hashem. Right now, he's forgetting for a moment that this is who he wants to be. So we need the kfiya in order to allow his general commitments of life to express themselves. There is discussion some posts can have that if somebody, let's say, is a mummer, if somebody has declared that he's not interested in complying at all with the demands of the religious community, maybe we should say that the kfiyah doesn't make sense, that it only makes sense for somebody who otherwise has indicated that this is the life they want to live. So then right now there's a deviation, so we can say that we're restoring you to your original will. So that's he discusses that in the Hakdamah to the Sefer as the hashkafic import of the Rambam statement there. Whether or not that is the underlying theory behind kfiyah as a whole, or specifically gittin, and whether or not this difference between gittin and mitzvos, that's something that we'll have to explore. So we'll just chazer we'll get up to, and then we'll have to clean this on Monday. One of the major things that we didn't get to today, but is very much, especially if you saw the tzos, is going to very much also segue right into the gittin question, is who is doing this kfiyah? Is it something that an individual does or a bezdin does? If anyone see the tzos and see this in the Meshovev Nesivus? Right, so you know how it works, right? That the Meshovev Nesivus, it's almost like a debating club. It's really fascinating, the whole relationship between the two. So the Meshovev Nesivus is the Ksos's responses to the Nesivus' attacks on him. So this is a very major, they argue on so many things, this is a very, very major mechot between them, which very much is going to segue from this idea that Sevier. So sometime between now and Monday, try to see it. The Tzos, he takes a stand on what kind of enforcement panel you need, and the Nesivus disagrees over there, and then in the Meshovev Nesivus, the Tzos comes back and restates his position, which brings us right into the getting point. Okay, so just to quickly review what we spoke about today. So we spoke about the Chikri Lev, about the distinction between Arvus and Tochacha. We spoke about the question of how exactly this should be viewed. Should it be viewed as an onesh or not? There's been a Yonah who says that it's essentially an onesh, and then he makes the point about Poshi Yisrael Begufan about Bal Tigra. We talked about whether he meant that literally or not, to how exactly to deal with the technical problems that are involved. And then we talked also about the Rashi over here that sounds like it's specifically before there was the Aveira, whatever that means in this sense. And we talked about the Or Samech and Halchos Mamrim, but if you know it's not going to make a difference, then you should do it. We got into the technical questions that Nachman was asking the Sharon Sinan of Halacha, discussed about the sukkah situation, what exactly is the scenario of the sukkah, and how he was working off the premise that it's an onesh, and that's what created some of the technical problems. We discussed the Ramban, this commentary to Chumash, about rebellion, and how that is very significant and going to affect a lot of things here. We talked about the question of whether there's only Be'aseis or is it Ba'alos Aseis also. How do you understand the distinction that Gemara is making? How that was apparently a machlokus between the Rambam and the Sefer HaMitzvos and Tosfos, and also between the Maram Shift and Afla versus the Chavis Yar. And then we talked also about the question of what would you accomplish by being forced to do a mitzvah? Is it that we're interested in that? How does this relevance to the Mitzvah Srichas Kabbalah debate and everything that comes out of that? And we talked about the Sefer Achinuch's comment that you have kfiyah by mitzvot, which he says is by carbon pesach, and then Menachas Chinuch says because the mitzvot before this were result oriented, so you for sure had a factor. The question is here, when it's a personal mitzvah, should you still stick to that or not? And then we talked about the Rambam. Here, the Rambam who says that we can kofir by a get because the Pintaliyah wants to do it, and that's what's coming out. So many questions to ask about the application of this to other things and the like, the factor of Ratzon, which we find Ratzon by a get and Ratzon by a carbon in this week's parsha. There you find Rotza Ani, apparently to parallel Ratzon, why by mitzvahs you don't necessarily find that, and then the question how this impacts even hashkafically. We talked about this introduction to the Sefer that parallels this to what we just read about in Purim time, about the Jews re-accepting the Torah that they originally did not want to accept, and how they had the mountain forced upon them, turned upside down upon them. And how do you understand how that matches Nasa V'Nishma, opposed to saying that we were afraid they're going to change their mind later, the Maral saying the point was being made that the world can't exist without the Torah, but this Mechaber suggesting something different, that we have to allow the Ratzon to have a commitment function, otherwise it's not going to ever work, and that was the message that was being made, that just as much as your Ratzon is here, but that also requires that there be some enforcement of that Ratzon throughout the circumstances, and that could be what the Rambam is basically getting at, is that we've established this is a person who has the ratzon to be a good person, so once that's the case, we have legitimacy in compelling him to be consistent with that image, and that's essentially how this operates. So a lot more to say about this, but we'll have to continue soon, and we will stop in a minute. Actually, for example, I'll